This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to the first episode of the SI Boxing Podcast in 2020. New year, new decade. A lot of new fights to talk about, a lot of boxing news to get into. Thanks to everybody for listening last year and the year before and the several years this podcast has been on the air. Thanks to everybody that subscribes, that rates, reviews. That is extremely helpful in building out this podcast, so I really appreciate all that. If you haven't yet, just go over to Apple Podcast, post a rating, leave a review. All that stuff is, as I said, really useful. But it is a busy time in boxing, the end of 2019, and we kind of look back at the year that was, the numbers that we saw come out, and certainly what can be with the multiple boxing platforms. No better time to check back in with a true friend of the podcast. Evan Rutkowski, a former HBO marketing executive, has the podcast of his own, the Fistianos Podcast, that you can listen to every couple of weeks, and he joins me once again. What's up, Evan?
Happy to start off the decade. Thanks for having me back on.
New decade, I guess kind of a new decade, though people get...
Yeah, that's debatable.
That's another source of social media outrage where people get all upset about, you know, the decade.
Yeah, but we'll call it a new decade.
We'll call it a new decade. So let's jump right into it, and... You know, one of the first, you know, more interesting boxing pieces of 2020 was a two-part deep dive that Thomas Hauser, a longtime boxing writer, author, investigative reporter, he did a pretty fairly substantial dive into DAZN. And, you know, the first, what is it, like 16 months, 18 months, whatever it is, of DAZN's existence. And he looked at, you know, where they started and where they are and what... You know, what they can be, and kind of looked at the sustainability of it all in a two-part series. So let's just kind of start in the big picture. You read it, obviously, and you have a lot of you have a deep boxing background. What was the most notable item for you from that two-part story from Tom Hauser?
Well, Tom Hauser, anytime he does something like this, everybody in the industry takes note. I mean, he is, you know, pretty much the best at doing this kind of thing. And I mean, the first thing that stuck out for me, and I'm sure all of my former colleagues at HBO, is that this is the type of story that, like, when I first started at HBO, he kind of did a story like this, so, you know, about a decade ago. And it struck the fear of God into people. You know, that was a true, like, I think it was like a three-parter, it was incredibly well sourced and it was incredibly well written. And, you know, I guess I don't know if it would be fair to call it a complete takedown of HBO, but it was pointing out a lot of the things that were going on behind the scenes that weren't working there at the time. And I, you know, with this, I felt like, just from an overall sense, like, I don't get the sense that DAZN employees are ducking for cover with this. Like, I think it was a pretty fair assessment, and maybe he doesn't look at it through, you know, I think you could be a DAZN executive and read this and agree with a large portion of it and then just kind of disagree on the level of optimism that you walk away with when you read it. You know, because in the end, I think it was a fairly well-balanced piece, but he didn't have anything truly egregious to say about what DAZN was doing, except for the fact that it may not be sustainable, and that could be bad for the people who live in the boxing industry and have lived there for a long time. Whenever a disruptor comes in like this, you know, and they don't have a boxing guy, you know, stuff like that. Like, I understand those kind of critiques, and I think pretty much everybody at DAZN would just nod their heads and say, yes, we're trying to disrupt this. And that's what's happening. And we don't have a boxing guy, and that will cause problems for some people, but we're trying to disrupt it in a unique way. And there were some bumps in the first year. But we also, he admits that it was a great value for consumers. So, and you know, in the end kind of compares it to Amazon, which I think, you know, is a natural you know, there's so many successful, and there's also plenty of companies that failed in their attempt to do it that you could compare DAZN to, but that's one of the successful ones. And, you know, I think it is still worth noting that Netflix and Amazon are fair comparisons to what DAZN is attempting to do here.
Yeah, you said a couple of things there, and let me ask you this. The lack of a quote-unquote boxing guy is something that Hauser wrote about and something that comes up when I talk to promoters and rival network executives about what goes on at DAZN. I mean, John Skipper, of course, at the top at DAZN. Joe Markovsky is involved with a lot of deals. When it comes to Matchroom stuff, Eddie Hearn basically makes his fights the way he wants to make them. Do you look at DAZN and think they need that, you know, quote-unquote boxing guy that Peter Nelson or Ken Hirschman or Ross Greenberg or Steven Espinosa, they need that guy to be successful?
I probably think they do, but it's worth noting that ESPN and Fox don't have boxing guys either. And now, granted, boxing isn't their top sport, which for DAZN, at least in the United States, boxing is the top sport. And you do want someone to look out for your own best interests that a quote-unquote boxing guy would be. But boxing guys who can operate in a corporate world are tough to find. They don't just magically appear. And you know, I was there with Peter. He had a sharp learning curve from a journalist who sometimes worked in boxing to being, you know, a boxing guy. Steven Espinosa was a lawyer who worked on boxing deals, but was at one of the top TV firms, you know, deal-making firms in Los Angeles for the entertainment industry as well. I mean, they don't just magically appear. You have to be able to get the respect of promoters and managers and fighters and trainers who've been in the industry for a long time and will always make their living from the industry. But you also need to be able to walk into a corporate uptown setting and feel comfortable there too. It's a really tough person to find. So, you know, I think it's fine to attempt to do it without a boxing guy. But you are, some of the mistakes that Hauser point out that DAZN has made are things that is a result of not having a boxing guy. And would that change with a boxing guy? I don't know. I mean, HBO and Showtime have you can look back at their last decade and they've made plenty of mistakes with boxing guys.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, they just post boxing guy job. Just that's it. Just need boxing guy in there. Look, I don't know that you need a like Lou DiBella type to make the big deals. I mean, you know Canelo, the guys you want him to fight. Yes, there's a certain financial structure you want to try to follow, but the bigger name guys, you can figure out the fights that you want there. I think when it comes to the lower level guys, that's where having people more experienced with boxing can be valuable. Like, and I'll use Virgil Ortiz for an example. Like, you know, Virgil Ortiz fought Brad Solomon in his last fight, and I mean that fight was ridiculous. Like, Brad Solomon was good, like, as an amateur 15 years prior or whatever it was, and when you have guys like Virgil Ortiz, and you know this, more often than not promoters are going to want to give them the softest touches that they possibly can. And with DAZN, they've got some really good young prospects. They've got Virgil Ortiz and Ryan Garcia with Golden Boy. They've got Devin Haney, who's kind of well past the prospect stage at this point. I mean, you've got to make sure that these guys are fighting real fights. I mean, I was, you know, tweeting out and saying to anybody that would listen that I want to see Virgil Ortiz against Thomas Delorme. Like, that would have been a step-up type of fight. I mean, that's where I think the quote-unquote boxing guy is useful, in identifying what is a step-up type of fight for a prospect and not just somebody they can drill and collect a paycheck.
Yeah, and you can make an argument, and I'm sure Golden Boy would, that Brad Solomon's a tough, awkward style, but that's still when you're in the development stage. I mean, Virgil Ortiz is headlining a show, and if you want to stick him on the third or fourth undercard of a pay-per-view and stick him against someone like Brad Solomon, that's fine, you know, or of a bigger card, I guess, in the case of Golden Boy's relationship now with DAZN.
Completely agree, yeah.
But, you know, like, he yes, awkward style, but he took him out quickly. When you're headlining an event for DAZN, yeah, that it should be a higher level than that. It should definitely be a higher level than that.
Yeah, I was never. I mean, I guess Brad Solomon had an awkward style, but like, and I had this argument with Sergio Mora because like Sergio, you know, called the fight and was. And he liked the style matchup, but I said to him, Sergio, like Brad Solomon just ran the entire time. Like I don't know how that's useful for a guy that is, especially coming off a fight where he had Antonio Orozco before. That was like a step up fight. I would have liked to continue to trend in that direction. But I think
Orozco's great.
Yeah, that was an excellent fight for Ortiz, and he had an excellent performance in that one. I'd like to see him going against Delorme and then start building up, you know, against those top 10 type of guys in the rankings. Hopefully that happens in 2020. Same thing with Garcia, who I actually don't mind the Fonseca fight for him in February, because I think it's going to lead to Jorge Linares, you know, in his next fight. And that's another step up fight. Like Garcia Linares is an excellent fight. I don't know what you think about that, but I think that's a really good fight in mid 2020.
Yeah, I like for Ryan Garcia, I think Linares is at the point in his career where he's a great test for Garcia. We should learn a lot about it, and stylistically, I think that one works too. And you can, if you see that, if that's really how it builds, then great. I'll take Fonseca, and then I'll take Linares.
Yeah. Sign me up for that fight in the middle of the year. One of the things that Hauser wrote about was about, you know, the ability for DAZN to build fighters in the same way that HBO did and ESPN and Fox can do with their sort of fire hoses at their disposal. I mean, ESPN can put Teofimo Lopez on SportsCenter. They can do, you know, these little profile pieces on him. They can do a lot. DAZN doesn't have those kind of, you know, those promotional tools, those substantial things at their disposal. I mean, you were working at HBO. I mean, you know, what would your advice be to, as a marketing guy to DAZN, about the ability to kind of build fighters with the resources that they have?
Well, there's a lot of different elements to it. I mean, I think, you know, there's a playbook of sort of bringing fighters through. And I think this is where, you know, HBO had this really well-defined programming where it's like, okay, you come on and you're going to hit a point, you know, hopefully early on where you're getting, you know, if you're going to become a star, you're going to start out where, yeah, maybe it's an undercard here or there, but you're going to eventually get to the point where you're headlining a Boxing After Dark. And when you're headlining, you headline a couple Boxing After Darks, and then you kind of graduate to World Championship Boxing. And at that point, HBO really had this team of people, and I was part of this team, that will start putting some money behind the fighters. And there were some people who specialized in creating marketing materials that video materials, you know, visuals that just really, these are people with strong institutional knowledge of how to just create top level materials around a guy. And I think when you put those two factors together and then you start to put money behind a guy and they start to get larger and larger TV ratings, you can kind of, you have the length of time to analyze what types of marketing materials work, what types of marketing materials don't work on the marketing side. You have the programming side analyze what kind of opponents work and what kind of opponents don't work. You kind of just, you can build this strong case. And these are years of established brands. And then eventually they get to pay-per-view. And then there you can really work to eventize the event and through a series of both, again, opponents and then marketing strategies, you get to the point where this fighter is truly a pay-per-view star. And that's years of having an established brand of programming and having marketing people both on the media spend side and on the material creation side who just have a deep institutional knowledge about the sport, what type of stuff works, how you can place it out in different areas. You know, HBO was great about creating little 10 and 15 minute programs, vignettes about certain fighters that were just, you know, really strong like storytelling vehicles. And I think that really worked to propel fighters to the next level. And look, I mean, DAZN is in their first year of doing this. They don't have any of that yet. They're working to establish it.
Yeah, and I think everything you said there, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like DAZN could do that. I mean, HBO didn't have this massive fire hose either to put guys out there in front of. They certainly had more, subscribers, than DAZN has, but it's not like they used, Turner all that often or used the major broadcasters they were partnered with all that often. They did it through what you're talking about, kind of vignettes and things like that and building guys that way. Do you see that, like DAZN being able to duplicate that? Is that something they could, a model they could follow to build these stars?
Oh, I definitely think they could. And I mean, if one of the critiques you have to lay on DAZN's first year is they didn't do a whole lot of shoulder programming specifically for core fight fans. A lot of their programming that wasn't just the actual fights was geared towards, casuals, when they're doing some of these countdown shows and stuff like that. They're just really short and they're slick and they're really well done, but they're short pieces that are meant to be put out on YouTube and create awareness and not really get core fight fans excited about a certain fighter, basically.
Yeah, I do think that's something that should be explored in 2020 for DAZN. A lot of things I think they want to do. The awareness part of it too, I think, is one of the biggest things for DAZN as they go into 2020 and beyond, because I'm reminded often of a conversation I've had a couple of times with Sergio, where Sergio has said, like, Mexican fans don't know what DAZN is. Like, they just don't. And this is Sergio from East LA talking from his own experience. And one thing I think would be something worth exploring is having kind of, when Logan Paul fought KSI, whatever you want to say about that fight, one thing I thought Logan Paul did extremely well was he created a video that was like a tutorial for how to download DAZN. If I was working with DAZN, the social side, I would have, every single fighter that fights in that network have something like that and have it pinned to the top of their social media profile, top of their Twitter profiles or Facebook or Instagram. And that explains how to get it. And especially when you've got, they've got so many, Mexican or Hispanic fighters now. You've got Munguia fighting this weekend. You've got Canelo coming back in May. Even Mikey Garcia, can attract that audience. That's the audience that I think could make or break DAZN, like the Mexican audience that I think is still needs to be tapped into to a higher level.
Yeah, that's, and even going back to the Hauser piece, I think that's one of the things that he really articulated well. It was a good point. It's like, what DAZN's trying to do, the cable and satellite industry is one of the last places that usually it's an older demographic. And I think, boxing does now have, it definitely has a younger demographic, especially Hispanic, that will show up and African-American as well. But in terms of the older traditional fight fan, these are people who are still cable subscribers and they aren't aware of how to download some of these things. And I think, in terms of DAZN's awareness, I thought the partnership they did with, I think it was Comcast, it sort of bridges that, is one of the first ones that bridges that gap, because what they started by doing is just by spending a ton of money. And when you're introducing this new brand and you're trying to court fight fans, it's really tough because they went really, really broad and it did increase their brand awareness a lot. But to Sergio's point, boxing fans, it's still a demographic that there's going to be a gap there between understanding what DAZN, first hearing about it, understanding what it is, and then understanding the value that they're presenting you. And that's just, it's really tough. What you said for the YouTube fighters, what Logan Paul did, I thought that was genius. And I've actually pitched that on pay-per-views before as well, in terms of like, hey, you should just show people how to download and watch your pay-per-view through an app, because there's plenty of ways now through other distribution forms, not just through your cable box, that you can buy a pay-per-view. And it totally makes sense. And there's a huge group of people that aren't getting that messaging and just don't know how to do it.
Yeah, I think finding those people and showing them how to do it, making it easy for them, I think that's a big part of the success in 2020 and beyond for DAZN in the U.S. No doubt about
agree.
That.
Agree.
Let me ask you one thing about what Eddie Hearn said to me in a recent podcast, and it kind of got cannibalized by a few people, like Rick Glaser had something, and Lance Pugmire had something that I was texting him and talking about. Eddie said that he would like to see DAZN raise their monthly price from $20 a month to $50 a month, and just as a vehicle to get people to subscribe for the monthly pass. Basically saying, like, if you want to watch Canelo and you're willing to pay $50, great, but we got this monthly pass option just to make the annual pass, just to make that so appealing that people just kind of have to go to it so they don't look like idiots paying $50 for 1 month. What do you think of that idea?
I think that's just a very boxing-centric idea. If for DAZN to really succeed and break out in the American sports market, eventually they're going to want to get the NHL or NFL Sunday Ticket or, you know, an NBA or MLB package. And that $50 a month doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you're in that type of world. I think in the fight game, it does make sense, but DAZN has ambitions beyond that. And so I would say, it might make sense right now, and it might encourage the yearly subscriptions right now, but if you accomplish your goals and you get to that point where you do get one of these bigger packages, how is that going to work? I don't know. And I would guess that's the hesitancy from DAZN internally there as well.
Yeah, I agree, and I think you're right. It is more of a fight fan-centric thing, and I think Eddie wants to make sure that every boxing fan is subscribed to the yearly pass as opposed to just the one-offs, but yeah, if you're looking at a bigger picture plan, it is a little bit more problematic. All right, let's look beyond DAZN for a second, and we're coming up on the first big pay-per-view of the year: Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, Wilder's heavyweight championship on the line. That fight's going to be a co-pay-per-view with Fox and with ESPN. It'll get a lot of promotion. It'll get a big push from both networks going into that fight. But let me ask you this. You know, Bob Arum's out there saying could do 2 million, pay-per-views. I saw Joe Tessitore suggest that it could exceed 4.6 million. That seems a little pie in the sky. But in a general sense, it got me thinking, should fans root for the success of pay-per-views? When I say that, I mean, like, if Wilder Fury tanked, would that not force, Top Rank and PBC to start thinking more outside the box, ways to do things that don't involve pay-per-view? I mean, it's sort of a weird question, but should fans root for the success of pay-per-view?
So I think for those big events, or what everyone hopes with Wilder Fury 2 is a real big event, I think you have to root for the success. I mean, right now, Fox and ESPN are working together and they're putting a lot of resources behind this. And that can be challenging. I mean, HBO and Showtime, when they worked together, it was challenging. There's no doubt about it. And so I'm sure it's challenging for Fox and ESPN, but if this thing doesn't work, I think it discourages working together again. I think it discourages, ESPN and Fox crave these big events. It's really important for them on a sporting, in terms of just programming and marketing sports, to have these big events. It gives them a lot of huge benefits when they distribute it. And to do it, I mean, at the core of this, PBC and Top Rank understand, and I think Fox and ESPN understand, that when they put on one of these big events and it really works, that accomplishes so many goals for them and it keeps them invested. And when boxing's not at this level at those places, it's just further down on the list. I mean, especially at a place like ESPN, who just does so many sports. But, Fox too. Fox does a lot of sports. And boxing, I think you can sit there and say boxing is doing well, and it's certainly doing well for something that was perceived as a niche sport and is probably still a niche sport. But you can't compare it to the big sport leagues and some of the bigger events that even, golf and some of these other sports can produce. I think you have to root for it.
Yeah. I mean, look, has there ever been a pay-per-view that will have this kind of promotion? I mean, you're going to have the Super Bowl presumably having, Wilder Fury ads rolling into it. You're going to have NBA games having these ads, the NFL playoff games having these ads. I can't think of an event that had this kind of potential marketing push behind it.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly going to have, if you look at the value of what this ad time is really worth, it's going to be much greater of a marketing spend or the equivalent of such than anything Showtime or HBO has ever done. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Now, it goes back to, like, do these places, can they do it correctly? Because I think it's one thing to just blast it out to the general public. It's another thing to make people actually convert. You know, these companies are used to doing tune-in, which, you know, the equivalent of, hey, Aaron Rodgers is playing Lamar Jackson on Thursday night or Sunday afternoon or whatever it is, and you can watch it for free here on Fox. Or same matchup happening on Monday night, you can watch it here for free on ESPN. This is, you're asking people to pay $75 for this, and it's a different way to strategize spending your money, and it's a different way to create the marketing materials. It's a much deeper ask for people. So I think if they can get over that challenge, which they, you know, I don't want to say they've, I think it's fair to say they've had some struggles with it to do that part of it. I think no one would ever turn down this type of general public awareness. And that is just such a huge advantage for them. So if they can make it work, you'll see more of these. And I think that's a really important thing, because I think right now Top Rank and PBC have a number of opportunities to work together and make some pretty special fights. And as fight fans, you hope they can continue to do that. You know, you don't want them to get discouraged by that. You don't want Fox and ESPN to just say, okay, we tried this in boxing and it didn't really work, and now we're going to kind of shove it off to the side.
Yeah, and to your point about the success of this Wilder Fury pay-per-view, I mean, if it is wildly successful, it moves us one step closer to Crawford and Spence, because if both Fox and ESPN and Top Rank and PBC see that everyone can make money off a major event, and look, as big as a deal as Spence and Crawford is, I don't think it's anywhere on the same level as a heavyweight fight between Wilder and Fury, especially considering they fought already and people have images of Fury getting off the mat. Like, there's a lot of momentum coming off that last fight. But if they see success in a joint pay-per-view, I think it's only going to motivate them to get into a room and do a deal for Spence and Crawford. Because really, Evan, I don't see how the deal is that much different than what Wilder and Fury signed. Like, my understanding is it's kind of a 50-50 fight in terms of purse split. And the winner of that fight, I guess, gets 60% of the split in the third fight. That should be the case in Crawford versus Spence. I mean, both those guys, I think, are kind of on the same level in terms of popularity. You know, whatever the blueprint or the framework for whatever they did for Fury versus Wilder should be the exact blueprint for Spence versus Crawford. So if this is enormously successful, just take the same contract, erase the names, and give it to those two guys.
Well, not only that, you've already had the companies work together once before in terms of doing this, so there'll be less of a learning curve, which I think is important. But look, I mean, I will say on that front that there are some concerns, because they've missed look, last weekend was a big NFL playoff weekend, and we didn't really see much, you know, they both had games and they both had opportunities to sort of push the fight. And we didn't see the spot. We didn't see a whole lot of push. And I know ESPN was pushing the McGregor fight. Now, granted, that's a month, earlier. I think that's January 18th. So they should be pushing that. But, this January and the Super Bowl are basically, that's when the most people watch TV. That's your biggest opportunity to push this stuff. So, you know, I hope we see it this upcoming weekend. I hope we see more of it or just see it at all. And certainly I hope we see it on the Super Bowl. I mean, that's a golden opportunity right there. And, you know, no money can you know, equivocate to Fox having the opportunity to talk about this fight on the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Now, the question, it goes back to, that's still 3 weeks out, and you have to convince people to spend $75 on it. But the awareness will be there for sure.
Yeah, so I agree with you on kind of rooting for the success of Wilder versus Fury. Where I kind of split is, I don't want to root for the success of these lesser pay-per-views, the $75 maybe for Gervonta Davis versus Leo Santa Cruz, if that's what we're forced to, if we're being asked to do. Even like Spence versus Porter was a terrific fight and a terrific matchup going in, but that's something I think that I would like to see a network like Fox get behind, use its promotional muscle with WWE and all the football games they had in September and promote that. I mean, those are the pay-per-views that I almost, you know, kind of, I don't really care either way because it's not my money, but I'm not unhappy if they do poorly, because then maybe it's going to convince these executives and these promoters to start thinking outside the box and find ways to do it on free TV in the case of Fox, or do it on Showtime and make it more palatable in the case of Gervonta Davis. I just think those lesser pay-per-views, Evan, they're killer, man. Like being asked to pay, if that's what it is, like, and this is what, you know, Davis's handlers are saying now, Davis versus Leo Santa Cruz on pay-per-view. I mean, who is paying for that? Who wants to see that fight? That is Davis in a slaughter in a fight like that. I don't see Leo Santa Cruz able to stay with him at all. So I don't know. I don't want to see those fights succeed on pay-per-view.
It, you know, it gets hard because you get into the math. I mean, and I agree, you know, in turn, you're really causing issues for the consumers on this front where you do the ones. And I think, you know, Espinoza has talked about this, and, you know, I think he put it around 250 or something like that. But like, there's just a number where the math doesn't make too much sense, especially on a pay cable level. And when you get down to the Fox and ESPN level, look, I understand there's some major challenges when boxing comes back on to free TV, or in ESPN's case, what most sports fans would consider a sunk cost in terms of TV on your cable package. And you're retraining. There's all these brands that, with the exception of some Mexican beers, haven't advertised on boxing or don't really have a relationship with boxing and understand who watches it and why they watch it. And that's gone on for years at this point. And so you're retraining all these brands to say, like, hey, this can actually be, there's some positives here. There's an audience that you're going to want to get to. And that doesn't happen overnight. But if you do focus on doing that, it's in your long-term best interest to focus on increasing the viewership numbers and increasing the brand engagement. And ESPN sort of had a year head start on Fox. And I think you're starting to see some sort of higher level brands, advertise on ESPN now. And I would anticipate seeing some more on Fox as well. I mean, it's a tough job for the ad sales team to begin with, but that's why you do these deals, because you get in front of, you know, ideally more eyeballs or the right eyeballs. And that kind of, it should propel you past some of these smaller pay-per-views. But that's not the way it's worked this year. I think we've just seen announcements that you're going to see X number of pay-per-views. I think, you know, four or six or something like that, that are pay-per-views that are going to happen no matter what in 2020. So you know, they're just marching ahead. I mean, that's kind of what the UFC did. They just had a pay-per-view a month and did two or three of them really big. And for the smaller pay-per-views, your buy rate isn't big, but, you know, you're just generating revenue from your core fan base, basically.
Yeah, and don't you think, like, I keep going back to the Spence-Porter fight, because I looked at that as a major missed opportunity for Fox, because, I mean, I'm not sure exactly how much Spence and Porter were paid for that fight, but maybe Fox would have lost money if they put that on the air. But if they had spent the month of September using NFL games, college football games, WWE events, Friday Night SmackDown, which I think aired like the Friday before that Spence Porter fight, I think it debuted or something like that. If you had done that and then had done like a massive number, like, I don't know what a massive number would be, 6 million, 7 million viewers for Spence versus Porter. I was throwing that number out there. Couldn't you then turn around to like advertise that and say, look, this is what big time boxing does. It does this many viewers. Wouldn't that be kind of a carrot to attract advertisers in?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and the issue is we just have so few examples of that over the past 20 years. And I think especially the way the TV industry has changed as well, especially with the younger demographics. I mean, you know, sort of fleeing from places like network TV to draw that kind of an audience as well, it's just so important. So I think it's a risk worth taking But I do understand. I mean, look, you know, there are budgets, and I don't know how much, you know, I think what I heard, what I don't know, is Spence got somewhere between 6 and 8 and Porter around 4 to 6 or something like that. Mm-hmm. You can't really ever trust the reported salaries to the state athletic commissions, but it, you know, I think it's a risk worth taking. And I think even when you're paying multiple millions of dollars in fight purses, if you do get that big audience, that means everything. That's where you can really show that this, when boxing does it right, advertisers should come, and here's why. And, you know, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg argument there. I mean, I think, you know, we'll have to see. Hopefully we'll hope for more progress on that front. But I guess Fox isn't there yet in terms of taking the risk. They'd rather put a fight like that on pay-per-view. They're distributing it. You know, when Fox was in the UFC business, they weren't the distributors of the pay-per-view. I think they're really enjoying being a pay-per-view distributor in this new era for them.
Yeah, they love when people buy it digitally. they love those digital yep. numbers. That just increases their earnings on that. I mean, the other thing too is, like, you made the point of just sort of tapping into your core fan base, and you're tapping into fewer and fewer of them. I mean, you know this. The reported numbers that come out for pay-per-view buys, whenever I see reported numbers, I immediately cut 30% off the top of what they're reporting. Because, look, Evan, you know this, like, you and I've said this, I remember having conversations with Mark Taffet at HBO when he would say, or people at HBO would say, you know, on background, here's how many buys this pay-per-view did. I don't want to hear background. I don't want to hear kind of off the record stuff, because you have to put your name to it. Because, you know, at HBO, if they put out an official release, they had obligations. Like, they couldn't say something officially if it wasn't true. Same thing with, like, Fox and ESPN. For financial reasons, they can't come out and say something, you know, officially that's not true. So unless somebody's putting their name to it at one of these networks, I don't believe any of this stuff. And I know for a fact promoters lie about this stuff, because there's no downside for them to lie. Like, what's the downside for them just telling a reporter, oh, yeah, it was 300,000 pay-per-view buys? Like, they don't, there's nothing they lose out of it. They make themselves look good for allegedly putting on a good event.
Well, that, and I also just think, you know, I've tried to do this, and it used to be so much easier to figure out what a pay-per-view number would be. I mean, it's still complicated in sort of, you know, 5 years ago or 4 years ago, because you're dealing with a lot of different cable systems, and you don't really know the answer until like 6 weeks after the fact, because there's a lot of smaller cable systems around the United States that just don't get aggregated right away. But you can kind of, you know, we've talked about this before, where there's sort of a formula. But what's happened is the way that television has been disrupted, and the way television distribution has been disrupted, there's just so many different avenues to buy a pay-per-view now that I don't know how you can come up with an accurate number. And it's also, especially when there's different demographics of core fight fans who are buying the fight, they all buy it through different distribution mechanisms at this point anyway. So it's really, you almost, it's so much homework to go in and to have these relationships and talk to people. And especially if you don't have a direct relationship, you kind of have to double or triple check it. And then you kind of have to figure out, well, this used to make up X percentage of the buy, and this number, this place used to make up Y percentage, but is that changing now because there's so many different distribution systems? I mean, you know, DirecTV is a great example. They used to be so prominent in this, and they've just lost so many subscribers over time that you can't figure out what percentage they have now. So it's really difficult. I don't know how people come up with those numbers immediately after the fight. I mean, you're basically taking a digital number and extrapolating it, and I just don't see how that could be super accurate. It's really difficult, and it used to be easier, but it still was difficult 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, it's very complicated. I think my goal for Fox for 2020, and maybe ESPN the same way, although they have ESPN Plus, which changes things a little bit. But if you have a pay-per-view that you are reasonably sure is going to exceed 250,000 to 300 buys, absolutely, keep it on pay-per-view. Manny Pacquiao, always on pay-per-view. Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, on pay-per-view. But if there's a possibility it could be 200,000 or lower, find a way to put it on free, or in the case of Showtime, premium TV. Just find a way to do it. In the long term, it's going to pay off. It's going to help your product overall if you're willing to roll the dice and do something like that. Let me ask you, just to keep it on Fox to finish up here. Fox finished their year and they released some numbers to the general public as part of their end of year sort of promotion. PBC Fight Night, their telecast on Fox averaged 1.4 million viewers. According to Fox, those figures are up 12% over 2018. They are, as you always have to go back and forth with ESPN, 103% better than ESPN's average for top-ranked boxing telecast, which was just under 700,000 viewers. A lot of other stuff in these releases. In 2019, in the U.S., they consumed 2.1 billion minutes of PBC Fight Night on Fox. That was a plus 147%. You've seen all these numbers. You're much better at reading numbers than I am. When you see what Fox released as far as 2019 goes, what stands out to you?
Well, so every place is going to have a different strategy. So when you see the stuff like, oh, it did a lot better than last year. Well, you know, in 2018, Fox was still basically, except for one fight, they were in the last year of a time buy that PBC wasn't putting their top programming on. So it should have been better than 2018. And it's good that it was. I think when you see fights on Fox that have been promoted correctly or promoted, you know, with the benefit of being in the season of the NFL or having sort of the tail end of college football, when you see those types of things, they usually do pretty good. And that's an encouraging sign. That's an encouraging sign. The other stuff, like when you see that average, that's a low average. I mean, many ABC or CBS could probably put on reruns of shows that they did during the week and beat that. And you've seen that happen with PBC's sort of lower level Fox programming. But there's a lot of encouraging signs. Like there's a lot of sort of, when they do it right, you see, okay, look, this can be sustainable and you can go to advertisers with these numbers and with these demos and say, hey, look, This can work, and here's why. And I think, you know, for 1 year of having that story to tell, I think that's great. You know, you look. I also think there with the streaming and with Fox Deportes, it works out better than you think. But I mean, 1.4 million isn't. I'm sure PBC would have loved to do better than that. And I don't even say that in a derogatory way, because I think Saturday night is not a great night for television. So I think there's still a lot of positives to take away from this, but this isn't like, you can't just run around saying this is an unquestioned success. Like it's a mixed bag.
Well, why doesn't boxing move off Saturday night more? I've seen DAZN try to do it. Go on Friday nights. They're even going to go on a Thursday during Super Bowl week, with a card down in Miami. I mean, why do you think that we don't see more of that, you know, shifting away from Saturday night?
It blows my mind, honestly. It's one of those things where I mean, core boxing fans at this point are trained to do Saturday night. And I think for the really big events, I think it works. And it does for boxing promoters. I'm sure they prefer it because Saturday night is when you're going to get your best gate for a lot of these fights as well. But I mean, there's just, especially with places where there's holes in the schedule, there's opportunities to put boxing on midweek or Friday night. I mean, Sunday night, I think for the may or may not work. You know, we've seen some evidence on ESPN's tried that a couple times, and it may or may not work. I mean, you know, on the long weekends where Monday's off for most people, yeah, maybe it can work. But I don't get that. I think there should definitely be midweek boxing. I think it's a missed opportunity out there. You know, and I don't know whether this is fighters who only want to fight on Saturday. I don't know what it is, but I think if Fox or ESPN really put their foot down and wanted to experiment with it, I think, again, there would be a learning curve, but they would probably end up seeing some pretty good results.
Didn't Fox do like a big number with, what was it, Caleb Plant last January, like fighting on Sunday after a Cowboys game or something? Or
it was an incredible number. I think they did like 750,000 average, and this is over like one of those really long FS1 cards. And I think Caleb Plant peaked towards 1 million. So for FS1, that's incredible. Like, that's a really strong number. And it was dramatically higher than most of their other programming on FS1. And I think it's just such a great example because they did promote it during the NFL playoff game. You did have to change the channel. So it's not like it just came on right after a football game and it was going to automatically get a great rating because it came on next. You did have to change the channel, but a lot of people did. I mean, it really, and it was a great way for Caleb Plant to get a lot of eyeballs on him. It was, you know, FS1 doesn't draw the hugest audiences outside of, you know, maybe some racing, you know, type events.
Baseball, sometimes.
So the playoff baseball when they have that, or some of the bigger games and some of the bigger college football games. But it's like, that, I mean, that's a great number for FS1. And so it shows you when they do it right, they can really steer audiences towards boxing. And you know, people like Caleb Plant came through with a great performance. So that was great for him. And I mean, that's a win all the way around.
So if you, let me finish with this. If you look at the boxing entities out there, DAZN, ESPN, Fox, Showtime, you know, which of them is poised to have maybe the most significant 2020? Like, which, given everything we know about where they're at right now, which one are you most bullish on at this point?
Well, I think for 2020, DAZN has pretty much out and out said they're going all in again. And I think, I mean, they're what most people inside the industry would argue, and I think there's a huge element of truth to this. They're playing with funny money, and whether that funny money becomes real or not, like, they're able to pay so much more than anybody else and give the consumer so much more value than anybody else because they're taking fights that would be on pay-per-view and they're just giving them to you for your yearly subscription. So for core fight fans, I think they're going to have a really strong year. Now, I mean, they had an up, you know, Hauser pointed out, they had an up and down 2019 in some respects. I mean, I would even argue they didn't, you know, DAZN didn't put on a really great fight until April. In 2019, still ended up being a great year. So I would expect them to come really strong again. Fox and ESPN, I think ESPN, it really depends if they want to focus on ESPN Plus or ESPN. I mean, in 2019, you saw them focus on ESPN Plus. If they decide they want to focus on linear ESPN instead of ESPN Plus, I think they could have a really strong year. And, you know, Fox, again, it comes down to what fighters are going to pay-per-view, what fights are going to pay-per-view. I mean, we've talked about this. They were so inconsistent. You know, you look at that average number they did, and if you just look at the Harrison Charlo 2 fight, and you know, I thought the Kalnowski Areola fight was great, and you know, they did a big number for Keith Thurman when he came on and was in a good fight with Josecito Lopez. And you know, I know Porter Ugas didn't do the best number, but for core boxing fans, that was a really good fight. You look at that stuff and you're like, if that's free, that's great. Like, I love that stuff, especially when it's free. But then you look at some of their other stuff, and it's, that's why the average is so low, because, you know, like when Arislandi Lara is fighting Canelo's brother in a main event, it's like, who's watching that? Like, that's really tough. So for them, it really depends. You know, they've said they're doing 4 pay-per-views. Are they really doing 4 pay-per-views? And are they all going to, if 2 of the 4 pay-per-views are going to be Wilder Fury 2 and 3, and I don't think they would make Spence and Crawford this year. But if that's 3 of the 4 pay-per-views, then I'm really excited about what's going to come onto Fox. But if we're going to see more of the smaller ones, you know, it starts, that has a trickle down effect, and then you get the sort of the cynical matchups in the main events. So, you know, I think you got to give it to DAZN just based on the fact that they still have that huge checkbook, and they're, when they've done it right, they've made really good fights and they've given the consumer great value. So I think I would still go with them.
I think too, from talking to Eddie about this, and I've had a few conversations with him about his kind of mindset going into 2020, it is going to be more about that kind of, you know, finding the right matchups and bidding on them, as opposed to, you know, having one guy on 2 or 3 times during the year. And I like that. I mean, if you look at the most memorable fights on DAZN, you know, one of them clearly was Hooker versus Ramirez, which was a one-off for DAZN. I'm all for seeing more of that. I don't know about you, but Like I am the ultimate drum beater for Andrade versus Charlo. if I don't see that fight, I'm going to lose my mind. Like I might actually I'll be on the broadcast January 30th for Andrade. I might lose my mind on the air if Charlo is signed to fight. If he's signed to fight Eubank before that, I might actually lose my mind. Like just because that I need to see that fight. That is one of the biggest fights in the first half that can be made in 2020. But in a general sense, I'm all for that. The kind of one-offs of Andrade and Charlo and, you know, Tevin Farmer or whomever, like just, you know, even if you have these guys just once, that's the kind of stuff that gets people subscribing more than saying we've got middleweight champion Demetrius Andrade three times a year. Like, I think you got to, you know, take a big swing and do more of that in 2020.
I agree. And it's one of the things that you hear from, and I think this is both inside the sort of boxing community and then with core fans, you know, it's great for certain fighters that they're active. Like, it's, trust me, this is much better for Demetrius Andrade that he's active for three fights in a year or four fights in a year or whatever he did in 2019 than not being active. Like, that gets his name out there and everything. But if you look at who he fought, it just comes down to you want to see the big fight now. Like, we've seen him, and I don't need to see him three or four more times against not the greatest level of competition. Like, I want to see him in a great fight, especially someone with his style that isn't necessarily the most TV-friendly. Then you look at him and you say, okay, maybe not the most TV-friendly style, but when you're in that elevated matchup against another elite middleweight, that's where there's a lot of tension, it gets really exciting, and you should be in those fights. And that's what's going to increase his fan base, especially with how talented he is. He could beat, you know, I don't know if you'd make him a favorite against every single middleweight out there, but if he's not a favorite, he's a live dog in every single fight. And so for him, it's, you know, you need to make those fights. It's critical. Like, that's how he breaks through.
Yeah, and if it's not Charlo, like, if you're part of Sergey Derevyanchenko's team, you're not getting Golovkin, at least not anytime soon. You're probably not getting Charlo on the other side of the street anytime soon. You want a title? Go get Andrade. Like, they'll make that fight. Eddie Hearn will make that fight in a heartbeat. Like, go make you. I mean, guys just tend to avoid him because they, first of all, I don't know if they think they'll lose. And he's not the most aesthetically pleasing fighter. He's not going to fight sort of, he's not going to come at you and engage with you. And that's just not how he ultimately wins. But I need to see, 2020 for me is like seeing Andrade in a big fight. I'm just dying to see him tested against one of the best, because I do believe he's got that top flight talent. I didn't ask you about Showtime. And, you know, it was good to see them back with they did a really good number, I thought, for the Davis fight, especially given the date. And I mean, they were literally up against the end of that Ohio State game. Like, that was, I was flipping back and forth as a boxing fan. As that game was coming down to the wire, that's when Gervonta Davis was in the ring. And they still did a good number, which speaks to the popularity, incredible popularity of Gervonta Davis. What do you think of Showtime's chances of bouncing back and having a strong 2020?
I think there's a really, there is definitely a pathway for them bouncing back. And you look at what Gervonta Davis did. It was so impressive. I mean, he actually, when you looked at the cable ratings for that Saturday night, he had the number 14 rated show of the night. And the top 13 were all on ESPN and were all related. I think it was the two college football semifinals. I think it was one other bowl game. And then all the pre and post games for each of those games. It was maybe the Sports Center or something like that. Like, he basically had the top rated cable show of the night that wasn't the ESPN college football semifinal bonanza. And that's just so impressive. And I think there's a pathway for Showtime to really have a great bounce back year. I mean, you know, there's a lot of industry rumors and I think just because with fans, they've seen it before with HBO. I mean, I've experienced it. And, you know, you feel like, oh, maybe it doesn't make sense on pay cable. But they definitely have a pathway for coming back. And, I mean, using Gervonta Davis correctly, I think, has got to be part of it. I think, you know, building more stars that they can put on Showtime from the PBC staple and say, hey, these are real Showtime fighters. Like, this isn't someone who's going to bounce back and forth. This is, you know, that's the one great thing you can say about Gervonta Davis. That he's a Showtime fighter. And getting some of those matchups, you know, I think Showtime probably anticipated that in the tail end of 2019, they would get some of those matchups. I mean, remember, Jarrett Hurd was supposed to fight Charlo, and that didn't happen because, you know, there were some upsets along the way. And the matchups like that that I think Showtime probably thought they were going to have and they didn't end up having. And then the whole thing with Deontay Wilder, they spent so much money on Wilder and it kind of blew their budget in a lot of other areas. So I think this year, just because of those factors, I think they'll be poised for a bounce back year.
How do you explain Gervonta Davis's popularity? Like, he's clearly connected with the urban market, which is something his promoter Floyd Mayweather did extremely well during his fighting career. But it's not like he's got a ton of quality wins on his resume. I mean, his biggest win was probably Pedraza, and that was a couple of years ago. How do you explain how he draws these kind of ratings?
Well, he's clearly tapped into a different audience outside of the core fan base. So amongst core boxing fans, you know, they're going to want to watch Gervonta Davis because he's a good fighter. I mean, he's a top prospect. He's not really a prospect anymore. He's a top young fighter at this point, and they're going to want to see him fight. Now, he's not fighting the best people. So when you start to extend out into sort of the core/casual, you know, boxing fan, you know, they're kind of like, okay, I'm interested in this guy, but I'm not interested in that specific matchup. But he's tapped into, you know, I don't think it's just the urban market. I think it's like, it's this hip hop culture that he's just figured out a way to capture that hip hop audience, which there's a lot of, I'm sure that audience, they're casual boxing fans, but maybe they only tune in for some of the bigger pay-per-view events or the bigger fights that aren't, you know, sort of the Canelo fights and that kind of stuff. Maybe one level of fight below that they'll tune in for, but they're not tuning in week in, week out for boxing. And he's captured that audience and they'll show up for him. He's done that really well.
Yeah, that number, I mean, it's one of the more impressive numbers of the year, given the date, what it was up against, the guy that Davis was fighting. I mean, there was really no buzz for Yuri Gamboa, you know, going into that fight. I mean, he was 38 years old and well past his prime, and to still put up that type of number is really impressive. You know, in your experience, do good ratings automatically mean good pay-per-view numbers? I mean, I look at a guy like Golovkin, who, you know, did like a million plus ratings on HBO pretty regularly, I think. He was more of a B-side pay-per-view guy, you know, than he was an A-side there. What do you think of the correlation between ratings and being a pay-per-view star?
So I think it's really about how you capture audiences. You know, I think maybe 10 years ago you would have said, you know, there's this core audience in boxing that's going to show up for most pay-per-views that's really small. And then there's sort of this other core audience that watches a lot of boxing. And the thing about the core audience is they're really smart. If you put on a matchup that's not pay-per-view worthy, they're not going to spend $75 on it. Like, it's just really that simple. So if you put on a fight where a fighter can bring another loyal audience and they don't really care whether it's on free Showtime or HBO or whatever it is, and then they don't really care whether it's that or pay-per-view, but they bring that audience to the table no matter what, they're going to do well on pay-per-view. And I think that's why Gervonta Davis has a great opportunity to be a pay-per-view star, because he's clearly bringing that type of audience to the table. And then when you do really well in a pay-per-view matchup, you are bringing the core boxing audience who agrees it's a pay-per-view worthy fight. And then you're bringing different segments of a casual boxing audience who will show up for their specific fighter together. And that's how you do a really good pay-per-view number. And then obviously when you hit the general public sort of level, that's when you're going to do great. But that takes a lot of time and a lot of work to get to that point.
You know, if we're talking like mythical joint pay-per-view type of matchups, I would love it if, you know, if you want to do Davis versus Leo Santa Cruz in the first quarter of 2020, I would love it if Showtime reached into its pocket and came up with enough money for that fight at, like, say, call it a catch weight, 133. Even, I mean, Santa Cruz will come up to 135 for that fight, which I think makes it even easier for Davis. But it's a great showcase fight that I think would do a big rating on Showtime. And then if Lomachenko beats Teofimo Lopez, man, you know, a joint pay-per-view with ESPN
and with Showtime, where you have the undisputed 135 on the line, I think that would do a pretty solid pay-per-view number between those two guys.
You can make a great case for that. I mean, or even if Lopez wins, I think, you know, right. Lomachenko Lopez is a star-making performance for either of them. And if I think, you know, that's kind of a tournament waiting to happen right there, where the fights really do lead to other fights. And you that's how you build stars, basically. Whoever comes out on top ahead of that is, you know, especially if it is Gervonta Davis, like that's how you truly become a star. And from then on, it matters. You know, you can hold a pay-per-view just on your own star power and do really, really well. I mean, Floyd basically wrote the book on how to do that.
Yeah, look, and they're trying to follow the Floyd path, but, you know, Floyd, before he was able to dictate, you know, he had to beat Genaro Hernandez and Diego Corrales and Jose Luis yeah. Castillo. I mean, he had to go in with some tough, tough opponents. I think that's just, I don't know if, Lomachenko is great, but Lomachenko 135, as we know, is a little bit vulnerable at times. I would love to see Davis test himself, you know, for the undisputed championship. That's the kind of fight that, you know, I understand there it's difficult to make a deal and make a broadcast arrangement, but if it's at all possible, that's such a huge fight that I'd love to see in 2020. Evan, always appreciate it, man. Always learn something when we have these conversations. Thanks for joining me here on the podcast.
All right, thanks for having me.